Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, I'm very pleased to have a returning guest to us today, Barbara J. King. And we talked with Barbara, it was over 2 years ago now. And she talked then about being with animals. And if you've ever had an animal who seemed to grieve the loss of another, you'll want to stay tuned and hear what she has to say today. She's an anthropologist. She does some fascinating work. And today joins us to talk about her latest book. And that's described as a poignant, thoughtful, and sometimes heartbreaking book, a work that elevates the discussion of animal emotion. I found it absolutely fascinating. And coming up in the second half of the show, we're going to turn the focus on you. Coach and author Jan Sincero's new book is called You Are a Badass. How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living in an Awesome Life. And that's coming up in the second half, as I said. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Barbara J. King with us. She's a professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She's the author and editor of many books, including the one I just mentioned, Being with Animals. And she blogs regularly for National Public Radio and reviews for the Times Literary Supplement. And her new book is called How Animals Grieve. Barbara King, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. I'm so happy to be back.
Yeah, very pleased that we could make this happen. And I just loved the book. I learned a lot about animals and just how deep their emotion can run. But I'm really curious about how you got interested in, you know, enough, because, I mean, it's quite a quite an achievement to write a book like this. How you got interested enough when you were wondering about, do animals grieve?
I have been observing monkeys and apes for my work as an anthropologist for a long time. And more over time, I became interested in how chimpanzees, gorillas, baboons express emotion as well as how they problem solve. So I started getting a lot of hints by reading the literature that some of these animals really do mourn the loss of a companion or a relative. And I think most of us have probably heard about elephant stories of elephants in the wild who grieve when a friend dies. So I just decided to learn by doing, if you will, learn more about the breadth of animal emotion by really immersing myself in what we can find out about the science. And it was fascinating because I found out that many more animals than I would have expected do show mourning. And that's why I got into it.
Yeah. And you say throughout the book that not all animals grieve. And I thought when I was reading this, Barbara, you know, some animals grieve and grieve deeply, not others don't apparently feel it. But I think that's true of human beings, too, right?
Yes, I think that the whole science of animal behavior is moving in a certain way closer to anthropology. In anthropology, we understand intuitively that people vary. We're not all the same, and we don't all feel or express the same emotions. And I think that goes for grief. Some people feel it more than others. Some people express it differently than others. But it all depends, right, on who has died, the personality of the survivor, the circumstances. And this is what we're finding, what I'm finding, for animals. So let's say there is an animal on the savanna in Africa, an elephant who dies, and there may be a virtual parade over the next, say, week of elephants who come past the body. Some seem very indifferent. Others seem very moved and very distressed. Sometimes we understand this by the closeness of the bond of the surviving elephant and the dead elephant, but sometimes it just seems to be personality of the survivor.
Mm. Well, your work is certainly at the forefront of science on this. Why do you think up until now not a great deal of research has been done on this? I know you cite somebody in the 50s who discovered how ants take care of their dead bodies, but not very much has been invested in this. Why do you think it's important?
Right. And by the way, in the 1950s, the ants, they don't grieve, as we might expect.
Right,
they just kind of carry off their dead companions and, you know, dispose of them. So
kind of like the soldiers we think of them. I mean, there's no emotion there. It's just, oh, there's a dead body. It's giving off, what was it, oleic acid?
Yeah, right. And let's just get rid of it and out of the way.
Yeah.
Very efficient. Well, in the 1970s, Jane Goodall, whom I think your listeners are familiar with as the most famous chimpanzee observer and advocate in the world, did write about a case of animal grief. So she told about a female named Flo who died of old age.
Oh, right.
And her son, who was 8, was with her at the time of her death, and he mourned at the body, but in fact became so distraught and despondent that he stopped eating and he couldn't recover. And Jane Goodall, being ahead of her time, as she has been in so many things, and such a wonderful, insightful person, she came out and said, look, this chimpanzee juvenile has died mostly of depression and grief. And to a certain extent, that began to reopen the field in the 50s, 60s, and before that. There was a very strict sort of view of animals as divorced from really feeling creatures. We were very careful not to interpret them in any kind of human terms. And, of course, there's a wisdom in that. We don't want to go too far and sort of willy-nilly project our emotions onto other animals. But thankfully, the pendulum is swinging back now. And there are ways I try to use in my research, to be able to understand that we may share a lot of emotions with other animals without just assuming that we do. We just have to look very carefully at what other individual animals do.
Right, right. And I think anybody who's got an animal at home, whether it's a cat or a dog, and I've even heard birds do the same thing. If, you know, I can think of times when I've been crying and my little dog would come up and lick my tears and snuggle up. Not the one I have now. He's like, get over it, woman. What's your problem?
There's a personality difference. Yeah.
Yeah. He's very smart, but he's like, he's got no time for that.
Too bad, Vicky. Keep moving.
I know. So, but I think we've all experienced that with animals. So they do tune into our emotions. So I'm wondering if you have, the book is a mix of science and stories that you share to illustrate the point. Do you have a favorite story in the book?
Oh, sure. And I just want to echo what you just said, that it's a little bit ironic because I think in a certain way, a lot of animal lovers and animal owners, if we accept that word, have been ahead of science in this way. You know, my husband and I live with 6 cats in the house and we are, you know, pretty tuned in to them, and even though they're not dogs, obviously, they're pretty tuned into us. And I think people who have horses, cats, dogs, rabbits, they tend to have a really good insight into this. But science, okay, we're catching up. So in terms of favorite stories, if I may, I'd like to tell 2.
Yes, please.
Okay. The first one has to do with wild elephants. And I opened our conversation talking about them a little bit because really they are what I call our touchstone. We have the most sort of grounded, incredible evidence about elephants compared to any other species when it comes to grief. And a scientist named Ian Douglas Hamilton and his team watched what happened when a matriarch elephant, the leader of a family, died. Her name was Eleanor, and she was very sick, and she was actually kind of swaying on her feet, and she collapsed. And immediately another matriarch from another family came up to her and tried to right her, to make her upright again, and pushed her up with great strength and with her tusks. But Eleanor fell again, and she could not survive this illness that she had, and so she died. And then it was through radio collar and tracking and observation that the scientists over the next 7 days noticed that elephants from 5 different families came to the body. And some of the elephants rocked over the body in distress. I mean, clearly, if you looked at them, you could see that they were upset. And others just explored and kind of poked at the body and moved on. But there was this great attraction to kind of come and see what had happened. And then again, this variable expression. And the definition that I've been using of grief is when an animal acts in a way that's quite different from his or her normal routine. And this is what we saw. There were some animals that stood vigil over the body and others that had this distress. And I was very moved by that. when I did some work in Amboseli years ago, Amboseli National Park in Kenya, I was not working on elephants, but some colleagues there were, and they told me that it is not terribly unusual for a family of elephants to divert their travel path across the savannah to investigate bones that are, say, bleached bones of what used to be an elephant. And it is sometimes the case that the kin, the closest relatives of that elephant that is now just bones, caress those bones, that somehow there seems to be a knowledge of who those bones represent, so that there's a link between those who come and spend time with the bones and the animal that used to be alive. So elephant grief is very strong. These are very smart and very sensitive animals. So that's story number one. I expected to find, again, say, dolphin, elephant, chimpanzee, gorilla grief, because these are our big-brained, very sentient mammals. So my second story is going to be a little bit different, and I'm going to talk about, and this is not a surprise from what I've just told you, domestic house cats, because we live with so many of them. Mm-hmm. But this story comes from friends of mine here in Virginia who had in their house two Siamese cats that were sisters, one called Willa and one called Carson. They were very good friends. They slept together and ate together. But more than just that, they really seemed very much taken up with each other's lives, so that when they would sleep together, they would really wrap up tight together, and they seemed very emotionally in tune with each other. Well, unfortunately, at one point, Carson became ill. She was taken to the vet, and she died overnight in an incubator and obviously never came home. Well, my friends, my human friends, were expressing their grief, and they were crying, and the sister cat who was left at home, Willa, seemed a little bit disturbed at first, but soon, within days, she began to wail. And some of your listeners who have cats may have heard this sound. It's like a keening. It's not a vocalization you normally hear from a cat. But whenever Willa went past a place in the house where she had previously curled up with her sister, she would let out this wail. Oh. And I found this extremely interesting because it wasn't just when my human friends were distressed, but rather when she, the cat, would apparently, you know, be triggered by a memory of where she was with her sister, she would let out this grief. And this continued for some time, and she was withdrawn socially, and she acted differently. Eventually, later, when other cats came into the house, she did perk up a little bit. But what this tells us is that a whole range of animals, those we live with as well as those that are in the wild, may express this in their own ways.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. And there's another story I want to share in a little bit that was one of my favorites. But we're going to take a very quick break right now. We're talking with Barbara J. King. You can find out more about Barbara at barbarajking.com. Anthropologist, and her new book is called How Animals Grieve. It is a really good read. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Get your smile on with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. We are talking today with Dr. Barbara King, anthropologist. She is associated with the College of William and Mary, and she's written a great new book called How Animals Grieve. It's really insightful. A lot of research went into this. Barbara, how long did it take you to put this book together?
I did research and also interviews for a little more than 2 years and then wrote it up. So it was a multi-year project, yes.
So one of the, you just shared a couple of your favorite stories. One of mine had to do with cross species grief, because we know that, you know, you've only got to jump on YouTube and see animals taking care of each other. You know, that I saw one the other day where there was a little baby goat with a tiger, of all things. Uh-huh. Maybe he was nourishing him, you know, and saving him for dinner later. But but we do see this connection between species. And one of my favorite stories in the book was of Bella the dog, a stray dog, and an elephant who just went everywhere together. And unfortunately, Bella did die. So share that story with us, if you would.
Yes, okay. Well, first of all, I know that this whole concept of cross-species friendships has gone absolutely viral in the last 5 years. And you're right, it's all over YouTube. But I want to be a little bit cautious about that, because two animals that spend an hour together and they look sort of adorable together,
right,
you know, that doesn't really meet my definition of friendship. So we want to be a little bit more skeptical, I think. But in this case, I found this to be a very good example of sustained cross-species friendship and then eventually grief. So there's a wonderful sanctuary in the state of Tennessee called the Elephant Sanctuary, and it is, I have not unfortunately been there, but I hope to go. There are rolling acres of beautiful land and elephants that have been in circuses, let's say, or other entertainment industry facilities or maybe certain zoos, come to the sanctuary and have what appears to me to be a very wonderful life. And Tara was one of these elephants, and she still is. She's still alive and well. And she did have elephant friends, but for reasons we don't entirely understand, she and the stray dog, a little white dog named Bella, who happened upon the property, just struck up a friendship spontaneously. In other words, no humans made this happen or engineered it. The two animals just started walking together. And one can find pictures of Tara and Bella on the internet. So you have this large, you know, multi-ton gray body and this very tiny little white dog walking along. And there's a picture in my book as well. Unfortunately, after a number of years of this very thriving friendship, Bella was killed apparently by a coyote or coyotes. And what happened is that, you know, Tara really did grieve. She just felt very sad. She withdrew socially. And she didn't seem to recover very well for a while. And I think that the reason I'm particularly interested in this story is it shows what we know sort of instinctively, because after all, when we grieve our pets or a pet grieves the loss of a human, that itself is cross-species grief. And now we see that it's evident in, you know, other animals as well. And I think that tells us a lot about the ability to connect across what are apparent physical differences.
Yeah, and I think the body of Bella, the dog, was missing, and it had been moved by Tara, which is how they assume that Tara had picked her up and moved her away from the attack, right?
Well, they hadn't seen that. This was circumstantial evidence. There was blood on Tara's trunk, and in fact, the supposition is that she may in fact have encountered Bella's body and moved her closer to where Tara herself lived. And I think that's a reasonable speculation, but we don't actually know that for sure.
Mm. There's a story in the book about a chimp. There are two chimps. Chippy, I think, was one of them.
Uh-huh.
And Pansy. And Pansy died. And the body was still there. Pansy's corpse was still there. But Chippy apparently kept looking everywhere for her and yet attacked the actual corpse. What do you think was going on there?
Chippy was rather violent with the dead chimpanzee that had been his companion in life. And chimpanzees are, for the most part, rather excitable creatures. And I don't know if this was a release of stress. I don't think that he intended to actually hurt the companion. I think he, you know, knew in some way that her life was over. But I think sometimes of what humans do, and I don't always like making one-to-one comparisons, but, you know, I have been at funerals before when people who are grieving, who are sad, and I include myself in this, don't always know quite how to act, and sometimes we may even laugh at inappropriate moments. It's a stress release, basically. That's one thought that I had about that. Otherwise, it's just one of the many questions that we still have unanswered. There was a really fascinating example of gorillas, close cousins of chimpanzees, where a silverback male lost his mate, a female who died, and the zoo very intelligently allowed the male to spend some time with the body. And at first, he literally tried to revive her. He brought his friend's favorite food, which was celery, to the body. But at some point, he seemed to really take a look and come to some kind of realization because he banged the cage bars and let out a wail. Mm. And I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, but I wonder if there wasn't a moment of realization there that death had occurred. He may not have a concept of death as we do, but some kind of a deeper understanding of what had happened. And I think back to the chimpanzee example, and I wonder, you know, did Chippy not fully understand? I mean, we just don't know. It's a hard thing to know what these animals are thinking.
Right, absolutely. And you make a good point. You know, the book does raise as many questions as it answers, really, because this is a fairly new science. One of the questions that you raise is about animal suicide. Do animals commit suicide? And I was really interested in that because my mother had a dog who was her constant companion. And as my mom got sicker and sicker and sicker, she couldn't walk her. And she would drive her it's a horrible story, but she would drive her in the car, you know, and just go very, very slow. And Susie would run around the fields and not come anywhere near the car. And then one day she ran right in front of the car.
And, oh, my goodness.
And unfortunately died. But I can't help but wonder. I wondered at the time, you know, if she knew Mom was getting sicker and she was going to lose Mom. And you just wonder.
Yes, there is a story that I tell in my book about a dolphin who, according to this dolphin caretaker, made a choice to kill herself. Now, one thing that I didn't know, and probably many other people did realize, is that dolphins are conscious breathers. In other words, they have to make a decision to take a breath. It's not automatic. So this dolphin caretaker made the argument that this dolphin, who had been in somewhat difficult captive conditions, just decided that she was no longer going to breathe, sank to the bottom of her tank, and died. Now, the problem, again, is, okay, that's definitely a possible hypothesis. Dolphins are very smart. They do make a lot of cognitive connections. But how do we know intention? And the same question would arise, you know, with the dog and this very sad story of your mom and the dog. We just don't know. And yet I think it is right to start asking the questions to see if we can get a database both of animals that grieve, animals that don't grieve, animals that might show something that would indicate potential self-harm, and really take a hard look and figure out if we can distinguish among all these various alternatives. You know, we're never going to find out unless we ask.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, because animals are very, very intuitive. They do, you know, my father always told me if they have a choice, they'll find a little hole to go away in and die. Uh-huh. And that was illustrated to me when I had my dog, Ben. I'd had him for 10 years. He was 11. And he had what we thought was a back problem. And he was scheduled to go in for surgery, but we couldn't get him in there because he'd thrown up and we had to delay that a couple of days. But I get home from work one day and he's not in the garden. It's just nowhere. And he would always be at the back gate, you know, waiting to greet me. And so a couple of the guys who lived either side said, well, he went round the back of the stables this morning and we haven't seen him since. So I go up there and I'm like, crawling through the bushes on my hands and knees in my, you know, business suit. And he's curled up in a corner. And I literally had to drag him out. And he did die a week later. So they are very, very intuitive. He actually had cancer. It wasn't a back issue at all. It was a tumor on his spine.
Oh, so. I see. Yes, and I think that part of the answer may be that animals in the wild, or animals who evolved in the wild and have since become domestic, you know, they're very much selected by evolutionary forces to seem strong when they're visible to other animals, whether it be to keep predators away, you know, don't choose me, I'm strong, I'm not the weak one, or if there's a dominant hierarchy or a pecking order, to seem very strong. There may be a tendency just to take yourself sort of out of the picture when you're not feeling well for that evolutionary reason that is kind of carried over. We've absolutely seen that with our cats. You know, we've had cats for a number of years, and we do rescue cats in Virginia. And one of the criterion that we use, if we have a sick animal and we're trying to make that difficult decision, you know, when is it time to put the animal down for the sake of the animal, to keep the animal out of pain? When one of our cats really goes and hides, then we take that very seriously. This is a signal to us. And so I really resonate with what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought of things differently. You said in the book that you actually see animals differently over the last couple of years since doing this. Talk to us a little bit about that, Barbara, and how your perception has changed.
Well, especially because I found out so much about the breadth of animal grief. So I don't eat cow and pig anymore. I am largely, although not totally, vegetarian. In other words, don't eat chickens. I think of animals so much as feeling their lives in a way that I hadn't quite before. I was partly there before. I mean, I've been an animal-oriented person for a long time, but somehow thinking about the examples that I turned up of, say, cows who are in factory farms, and they're continuously having their calves taken away from them, taken to slaughter, and these cows, you know, do grieve. They express by vocalization, body language, withdrawal, that they're feeling this. So it's changed my eating habits. That's one example. In thinking about dolphins, I personally have made the choice no longer to support places like SeaWorld, where there's a lot of entertainment for our sake, in which these beautiful cetaceans, dolphins and orca whales, are kept in captivity. And then I just, when I'm out in the world, you know, and I meet, walking along, you know, I see a bird, or I see a goat, or I see a chicken, I just think about how what they're doing every day, every hour in their lives means as much to them as what I'm doing means to me. So it's been sort of a very, very beautiful and heartbreaking process. I believe that grief for animals comes out of love, love they feel for each other. And it's a comfort to me in a way to know that we humans aren't alone in all of this sea of emotion that we feel. But I also know that it's sad a lot of times in what other animals feel.
Yeah, you actually start the story, or your introduction, with a story about goats and chickens, animals that you said you thought you never gave a second thought to having thinking processes or
mm-hmm.
feelings. And I think most people say, you know, chickens are dumb. They don't think or feel or anything. But you kind of disagree with that now.
I do. And the organization called Farm Sanctuary, which is, you know, a wonderful animal rescue organization based in both New York and California, has made a huge impact on my thinking. They have great books and websites and information, and I even adopted a chicken from the Farm Sanctuary, which does not mean that the chicken runs around my home, but rather that I pay for its, I have in the past paid for its food. So I just think the science of chickens, pigs, and cows is really coming to the fore, and we know that they can distinguish, you know, certainly between different individuals. They can do all sorts of psychology problem testing to show that they're thinking, and they absolutely do feel. So what I hope my book does is, you know, I'm not very much into telling people what to eat or how to think. That's not at all my approach, but rather to just to have every person think about what he or she wants to do in terms of relating to other animals and how our society relates to other animals. There's a huge sea change going on in how we think about the uses of animals in biomedical laboratories, entertainment complexes, and on our dinner plates. I think that it's very exciting.
Yeah. And just leave us with the thing that surprised you the most when you were putting this together, because I'm sure something really smacked you in the face as like, wow.
I think I would just have to say the depth of love that animals may feel for each other, and how, you know, it's true for us too. When we let people into our lives and we love them, we know that this may bring sadness to us because they may leave us. We have an awareness that our lives are finite. We have an awareness of death. I don't think animals necessarily do. I think that's a big difference between our kind of grief and theirs. But the huge surprise, I guess, to me was that it doesn't matter at all for that cognitive difference, doesn't matter at all for how we feel. I think we all feel, and that is a big message to me.
Well, Dr. Barbara King, I thank you so much for being with us. Dr. King, again, is a professor of anthropology at the College of William & Mary, and this is such a well-researched book, a blend of science and stories that are really interesting. Jennifer Holland, author of Unlikely Friendship, says she tackles a tricky subject with a scientist's care and an animal lover's grace, and I would agree. Thanks, Barbara, for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicki, both for the questions and for the generous discussion of my book. I appreciate it.
And you can find out more about Dr. King's work at barbarajking.com, barbarajking.com. And please do stay with us when we come back. We're going to talk a whole different subject here. We're going to talk about you being a badass. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to NuPro Supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week, September 15th, it's the third Sunday of the month, and that means it's a Kevin and Kim Sunday. Always entertaining, Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller, Medium and Animal Intuitive, will host the show for me. They'll have open phone lines so Kim can help you connect with your animal and human loved ones on this side or the other, so plan to give her a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Conscious living for conscious people. Alternative Talk 1150.
Some good kick butt music there. We are talking right now with Jen Sincero. She is an author and success coach who's helped countless people transform their personal and professional lives via her work through newsletters, seminars, private sessions, appearances, articles, etc. The list goes on. And a few years ago, she said goodbye to her home in California in order to, quote, travel the world indefinitely. And I'm going to bring her on and let her tell her story in her own words. Jen Sincero, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's so good to be here.
Well, your new book is called You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life. And who doesn't want that? But you weren't in that place always. So tell us a little bit about your background and what really made, what was your pivotal turning point?
Well, you know, I've always been a writer and a musician and just sort of a general all-around artist, and that was always great, but I never knew how to make any money doing what I loved. So I was doing a lot of things I was excited about, but I just could not get the financial piece down. So this book and my work today was really inspired by me being really sick of being broke all the time. And so I spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money on unhooking whatever my beliefs were around my ability to make money, my, you know, the availability of it to me and how much I deserved it and all that crap. And book and my now coaching practice is a result of all of the effort I put into getting over my own stuff. And now I teach other people how to do it too.
getting over your own self. That is the key thing, right? That's the key starting place. We need to get over ourselves. And I read that you had a nasty accident that laid you up for a few weeks. You were out bowling and you stepped over the line. Now, something that I did, but with much less serious consequences. So tell us what happened there.
It was so funny. No one's brought that story up. I was bowling, and I just think it's hilarious to even be able to say that I had a bowling accident because it's such a funny sport, you know, that it's even listed as a sport. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people who pulled out there, if you slide over that line, they grease up the alley. So if you slide over it, you will slip and fall. I'm 6'1", so I have a long way to go down. And bowling alleys are really hard surfaces. And I slammed my tailbone really, really hard to the point where I kept waking up in the middle of the night with excruciating pain in my feet, like it hit some nerve down there. So it was just this crazy accident that happened to me.
right.
Yeah.
But you had plenty of time then to think about things and put things in perspective. And so
yeah,
sometimes it
exactly.
takes that.
Sometimes. It can be a real gift, you know, to get laid up. I think any time that we're forced to get out of our rut, even if it's for something quote-unquote negative, I think we get so into, you know, just operation mode, where we go through the motions of living our lives and we go through all of our knee-jerk reactions. So sometimes anything that can knock us out of that day-to-day reality can be such a gift, because then you're forced to look at things from a new perspective. And as anybody who's done any work knows, it's all about shifting your perspective. So that can be a real good thing.
You have a great sense of humor. You've been I saw somewhere you were on, for one, you were on Howard Stern. You've got to have a sense of humor and a thick skin to go on there.
Oh, yeah, to say the least.
and on Comedy Central, how much has humor helped you get through things and turn your life around to a place where you're enjoying it?
Oh, my God. Well, when you don't hit puberty until you're 18, you better have a good sense of humor. I mean, it saved my life completely. Completely. And my whole family's really funny. And I'm just so grateful to have that. I mean, not only does it help you not take life seriously, which I think is the key to living a happy life, but it's just a lot more fun, you know?
Right. So at what point did you decide that this is the direction I want to go in?
Well, you know, it was interesting because my book Before You Are a Badass is called The Straight Girl's Guide to Sleeping with Chicks. And that, surprisingly, you know, I had this big lesbian experience for the first time in my mid-30s, and it completely threw me because I had no idea what the hell was going on. So I wrote this book about it just because I'm a writer and that's what I do, is I write books about my life. But it ended up being so much more about helping people get over their shame. I mean, talk about shame and fear and doubt and worry and sex. I mean, it's all right there. So I started teaching workshops and I started writing an advice column, and that was the beginning of my coaching career. It just sort of happened, but I was so excited and inspired by seeing people overcome their shame and worry about sex stuff that it sort of led into this new thing of just doing it with all sorts of different things, money and love and whatever else.
I've actually found that happens a lot with the best coaches. It's just something they're doing every day in their natural life, and then all of a sudden it just becomes this driving force to actually do it professionally. One of the things you talk a lot about in the book is that you were raised, like many of us, not to embarrass others. So even if somebody else has been rude or unkind to you or dismissive of you, you're still raised to not embarrass them. Talk to us a little bit about that and how you've come to see that in a different light now.
That's such a great point to bring up. I think, you know, we all come from this place of wanting to be liked and wanting to be accepted. And I think it's very primal. You know, if you get booted from the tribe, you're on your own, and then you get eaten by wolves or freeze to death or whatever. So it's this very basic human need. But we do it at such a dysfunctional way where we put other people's needs in front of our own, and we act as if taking care of ourselves is bad and taking care of other people's is good. But when you really think about it, if you do truly take care of yourself and you stand up for yourself, you're going to do everybody else a favor, because we're going to just go ahead and assume that you're a very good person. So if what you want is, if you go after what you want, it will benefit everybody around you, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at it that way. So mm-hmm. I think that's a huge one. Huge.
Yeah. And I especially think if you're a mother or even father, you know, sometimes people will say, well, you're being selfish, putting your needs above your kids, but you're setting an example. You're being a role model to them. So I think that's especially important there.
Yeah. And happy parents make happy kids.
Very true. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. You know, Mark Twain said, I have lived a long life and had many troubles, most of which never happened. When we come back, I want to talk about the drama of overwhelm. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Jan Sincero. Her book is called You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life. Please stay with us.
Sometimes I feel so nice, I want to try myself a few. I got soul, and I'm super bad.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Mainstream of talk radio. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I got it! Super bad.
I feel like being super bad today. So my guest book is called You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life. My guest is Jan Sincero. She is a coach, author, writer, and has quite a great sense of humor, as you'll see in this book if you pick it up and look at it. For example, one of the chapters is called Lead With Your Crotch. What's that all about, Jen?
You are really putting me to the test here. It's a double entendre. I was in a punk band in the 90s called Crotch. And that chapter is about, it literally is about leading with your crotch. It's doing what feels really good and fun and trusting that that's good enough instead of messing it up in your mind and deciding that you can't have it or that you won't make money doing it. And I know, just all the lessons that I learned from being in a punk band and going for it on such an audacious level.
Yeah.
Some of those lessons still have today.
Well, you say, you put a quote in there, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the experts, there are few. And that is so true when you really think. I can think back all of the, things that I did out of naivete. And had I known, I probably would have put like my own brick walls up.
Totally. Yeah. And I think also as we get older, you know, it's like you're supposed to be more responsible and you feel like you're supposed to act and look a certain way. And it's like, how fun free is that? Like, I certainly don't want to be, you know, face down in the gutter in a punk band anymore, but I still want to be doing stuff that's as fun
right.
to me now.
Right.
You know?
Well, one of the things I've had to learn through my life journey, if you will, is to not worry about stuff so much. Because I remember when I was 5 years old and I was standing in my grandfather's kitchen, and he was always full of sage advice. And I must have looked perplexed or worried or something, because he said to me, "What are you thinking about?" And I can't remember what it was, really can't. And he said, well, tell me this. He said, "What were you worried about 5 years ago?" And I said, "Silly, I wasn't even born then." And so then he goes, "Well, what were you worried about 5 months ago?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, how about 5 weeks ago?" And I said, "I don't know." But so many of us worry about stuff that is so unimportant, and we won't even remember it like 4 weeks later.
And I don't know.
You have a great chapter in here called The Overwhelm of Drama. So talk to us a little bit about how we create the drama of overwhelm. So talk to us a little bit about how we create our own dramas and how we can avoid that.
Oh, my God. If we got paid for all the time we spent creating drama, we would all be so rich. I mean, you know, we all have a lot to do, and there's always going to be a lot to do, and we're never going to be done with what we have to do. And it's like, if you look at it that way, if you just add heaviness to all the stuff you've got to do, as opposed to, holy crap, like a sperm and an egg came together and I was created and I get to live this life and I get to be me and I get to do all these things that I want to do. Like, there's so many different ways to look at your life, and overwhelm is created when you decide to look at it and only look at the stuff that's freaking you out.
Yeah.
It's so simple. I mean, honestly, everything is just so stupidly simple, but we just create these huge dramas around it. So, anyway.
Right. And I mean, we all know drama queens in our life. You know, they're always late. They're always canceling because, you know, I'm buried alive. I've got alligators up to my elbows. And I've been studying, not just reading, but studying Dr. Neil Fiore's work on procrastination, because it goes so much deeper than just putting things off. It's about how we look at things and how we, how we put roadblocks in our way, but how perfectionism plays a part and stuff like that. And we really do create our own drama, and we have a choice in how we show up and how we act. So tell us about some of the ways that you've helped to minimize. I don't think we're ever totally drama free because we're surrounded by people, but some of the ways you've minimized drama in your own life.
Well, I definitely don't hang out with drama queens anymore. I've been very good about weeding the drama garden. In my own life, I've gotten really strict about the idea that done is better than perfect, because you can spend, what a great way to self-sabotage. Like, the thing is with all this procrastination is there's always very good reasons. Like, of course you want your work to be good and perfect and da-da-da, but you can spend the rest of your life doing that. So that's a big one for me, is done is better than perfect. I've gotten really good at delegating.
Yeah, just repeat that again, because I think that's worth it. Yeah. Done is better than perfect.
Uh-huh.
And that's where so many of us get stuck. We want it to be perfect.
Well, and it is, but it is this sneaky procrastination thing, too, because you can get away with it being like, well, of course I want my work to be really good. I'm proud of what I do. And it's like, yeah, that's great. But you could spend the next 10 years pretending that's what you're doing. So, obviously, do a great job, but just get it done already. And delegating is humongous, and that's a big part of letting go of control and not being a weenie about spending money on yourself and your business and hiring other people to do stuff. That's a really, really big one, because it touches on a lot of fears.
Mm-hmm.
Prioritizing, well, you know, maybe not making going on Facebook and doing this other stuff more important than the stuff you really need to be doing.
Right, right. Well, that to me is such an energy drain. I don't know where people find the time to do it. And it's obviously coming away from something that's probably really important.
Yeah, and I mean, there's no lack of distractions out there, but, and I am all for taking time off, and I'm all for doing fun things that have, you know, nothing to do with anything but enjoying yourself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, why bother doing all the other stuff? But I think the more focused you can be while you're working and getting really diligent about, my biggest savior in everything, in my business and my writing life and everything, is when you chunk down time. Mm-hmm. Do you know that concept?
Yes, but I use that myself, but talk to us about it and tell us how you do it.
Oh, it's such a goodie. So basically, instead of saying I'm going to write for 4 hours today, which means I'll probably spend overall about 34 minutes writing and the rest of the time throwing around doing other things, if I say I'm going to write for the next 25 minutes and I set a timer and I'm unauthorized to go to the bathroom or get anything to eat or answer the phone or answer an email, where you just chunk down your time into little bite-sized chunks where you are doing only the thing you're doing, you get so much work done. There's some statistic that says something like people who work day jobs that are 8 hours a day, they really only actually do any work for something like 3 hours during that 8 hours.
Yeah, I can believe it. I believe it.
Yeah, right? So when you're an entrepreneur or an artist or, you know, trying to get stuff done on your own, if you maximize the time that you're at, you know, if you chunk it down and focus on your work, then you have all this other free time to screw off and do the fun stuff. So that is, especially as a writer, that I would never have written a book if I didn't do that.
Yeah. You know, another tip I want to share is something I was told ages ago. You know, stop saying, because I'm in the process of writing a book, and it's stop mm-hmm. saying I have to finish my book. It's I have to get started. Just go get started. Oh, I'm going to get started. Because once you get started, That's the big thing, right? Sitting down in the chair and making yourself do it. And once you get started, you get into flow and, you know, everything else comes about.
I know. Well, my favorite, I have this equation. People are always like, how do you write a whole book? It's like writing equals ass plus chair.
Yeah.
That's it. That's really all it is just sitting your ass down. So
that is so true.
Yeah. So no great mystery there.
I read that you went off on this travel extravaganza. You put your stuff in storage. You just went off with your laptop and traveled all around. One of the things that you said during that experience was learning yourself to surrender. So talk to us a little bit about surrender, what that means to you, Jen.
Ah, that's a big one also. Like, there is this clinging and shutting down that we do when we really, really, really want something badly. And it's great. I mean, you set your intention, you get very clear on what it is, you work your ass off in that direction. But the reason a lot of people don't get what they want, even though they're doing everything they know how to do, is because they don't surrender. So it's like this delicate dance where you do everything and you work your butt off and you get excited and you keep moving forward, but you have got to breathe and lean back and receive it. Because if you don't do that, you sometimes end up pushing away the very thing you want. So this is a huge concept, especially when you're trying to bust out of your regular life and your comfort zone, because you're looking for the thing that you want within the reality that you now exist in. And if you're trying to blow open the world, it's going to look totally different, and it's going to come in from a totally different way. So if you don't lean back and surrender and receive, you won't give it room to come in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's super esoteric and woo-woo, but it's
no,
really
I think, no, I am not a woo-woo person myself. Listeners, no, I'm not at all woo-woo. But I do think that is an important point, and that's why I wanted to bring it up. And it's a good note to end the show on today. But, you know, you have to let go of the outcome, because you can't control the outcome. You can control your output. You can control what you put into it. And then you, at some point, have to let it go. And you do have to lean back. And I like the way you describe that, lean back and receive.
Mm-hmm.
I got my arms wide open. I'm ready to receive, baby.
Yeah.
So,
you know what it's like?
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I just think it is an important point, Jen, to bring up.
And I'll just give like an example so people don't know what I'm talking about. Like, so let's say you're trying to meet the man of your dreams or something, and you're like out there and you're dating and you're looking. Most of the time, he comes in a totally different form. Like, I'm dating somebody now who, like, it's not the sort of person I'm looking for, and I love him. So it's like, if I had been pushing in the direction that I wanted, I would have missed out on him.
Yeah.
But it's because I, you know, you have to lean back and receive and expect the unexpected. And that, and thank God, I mean, it's a lot easier to take a breather anyway and instead of keep pushing.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for being with us today, Jen Sincero. Your book is called You Are a Badass, How to Stop Dating Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life. I enjoyed reading it. Thank you, Jen.
Oh, thank you so much.
And give us your website is what?
Well, you can reach me at youareabadass.com.
Okay.
Or at jensincero.com. They both go to the same place.
Oh, Sincero. I've been saying your name wrong this whole time.
Oh,
sorry
no,
about that.
That's all right. It's all the right way.
I loved the sense of humor, and I loved in here you said sometimes when you get bored and you're procrastinating, you go give yourself